Welcome once again to everyone out there in internet land as we do another study in the book of Daniel. And you may wish to debate this important point, but I would say that the story that we have before us today in Daniel chapter 6 is possibly the most loved story in the Old Testament. Well, as voted mainly by boys under the age of 9 years. Daniel chapter 6 is a great story. We've got an old man of God, young hungry lions, corrupt jealous officials, God-given supernatural preservation of an old man thrown to the young lions, and the bad guys getting what they deserve. Okay, apologies for spoiling the ending there for you, but there's a slim possibility that you've already read it. So let's just back up a little bit. In the previous chapter, we saw the end of the Babylonian Empire. In a single day, the Medes and the Persians took the city and they killed the Babylonian king Belshazzar. So in terms of King Nebuchadnezzar's vision, which we talked about from chapter 2, we have moved from the head of gold, being Babylon, to the arms of silver, with the Medo-Persian Empire now in control. And history records the date of Babylon's downfall as October the 13th, 539 BC. And Darius the Mede, who's been appointed by King Cyrus, is now ruling over what was the Babylonian Empire. Daniel is now in his early 80s. But as we'll see, Daniel is no ordinary old man. He's an extraordinary old man. A fact that will even raise the envy and jealousy levels amongst his peers and leave him in a very precarious position with some very hungry lions. All right, so what are we going to look at in this message? Firstly, how jealousy will lead to an evil plan being hatched against our godly Daniel. And how does this point to Jesus and life in many countries today? Secondly, Daniel's response to the new laws of the land. Did Daniel compromise his faith or trust in the living God? Thirdly, how can we shut a lion's mouth? How was Daniel protected when faced with certain death? And lastly, we're going to look at how the tables were turned. Why can we trust God in difficult times? And how the enemy was caught in his own trap when it came to his plan for Jesus. All right, so let's have a look first of all at the first four verses. And it says, it pleased Darius to appoint 120 satraps to rule throughout the kingdom, with three administrators over them, one of whom was Daniel. And the satraps were made accountable to them so that the king might not suffer loss. Now Daniel so distinguished himself amongst the administrators and the satraps by his exceptional qualities that the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom. At this, the administrators and the satraps tried to find grounds for charges against Daniel in his conduct of governmental affairs, but they were unable to do so. They could find no corruption in him, because he was trustworthy and neither corrupt nor negligent. So Daniel, as the NASB says, had an extraordinary spirit. He was different, and the evidence of God's presence in his life was clear for all to see. As the saying goes, the cream always rises to the top. And so Daniel found himself in this position of authority within the Medo-Persian kingdom, just as he had been within the Babylonian kingdom. Although this time he had a problem. The green-eyed monster called jealousy was rearing its ugly head again, just as it had many times before for God's people. For example, you may remember through the study of Joseph, we saw the extent of his brother's jealousy and where that ended up. Or you may remember Korah's rebellion against Moses, where he was jealous of Moses and he wanted the same position of leadership as Moses had. And let's not forget King Saul's jealousy of David, where this resulted in spear attacks and David having to run for his life. And, of course, we can't leave out the religious leaders' jealousy and envy of Jesus, which even the Roman governor Pilate picked up on. In Mark 15:9-11, it says, Pilate answered them, saying, Do you want me to release for you the King of the Jews? For he was aware that the chief priests had handed him over because of envy. So Daniel's in good company. Joseph, Moses, David, Jesus himself have all had people jealous and envious of what they have. People don't often like others who are different, especially if those others fear God and can't be manipulated. Well, our good friend Daniel was striking 3 out of 3 on those counts. And on top of that, King Darius was now thinking of placing Daniel over the whole kingdom. So through no fault of his own, Daniel soon had some pretty powerful enemies. They wanted him gone, out of the picture. And yet, search as they could find no corruption in him. Because scripture says he was trustworthy and neither corrupt nor negligent. What an awesome testimony that is. So what do you do if you've got someone that is blameless and can't be bought? Well, you hatch a plan. Let's have a look at that from verses 5-9. It says, Finally, these men said, We will never find any basis for charges against this man Daniel, unless it has something to do with the law of his God. So the administrators and the satraps went as a group to the king, and they said, O King Darius, live forever. The royal administrators, prefects, satraps, advisers, and governors have all agreed that the king should issue an edict and enforce the decree on anyone who prays to any god or man during the next 30 days, except to you, O king, and he shall be thrown into the lion's den. Now, O king, issue the decree and put it in writing so that it cannot be altered in accordance with the laws of the Medes and the Persians, which cannot be repealed. So King Darius put the decree in writing. So try as they might, like I said, they had nothing on Daniel. Imagine if that was said of a leader or a politician today. Okay, not likely. Doesn't really happen. Most politicians today only survive because they have enough dirt on each other to make sure that no one raises any issues. But this left Daniel's enemies with few options. Well, only one option, and that was to change the laws of the land to be in opposition to God's law. It's an old trick, but quite successfully employed even today. In fact, it's an old trick that's on the increase today. I read a quote on this that said, Today there are many sins that aren't crimes, and many crimes that aren't sins. Might take you a little while to get your head around that, but it is so true. Many, especially in the West, you know, live in a country where maybe it's illegal to smack your own child to discipline them, but it's legal to kill the unborn. Now, smacking your child is not a sin, but now it's a crime. Killing the unborn whom God has made, that is a sin, but it's not a crime according to the land. So you can expect things to get more mixed up as society moves away from God and the Bible. And you can expect the laws of the land to be used against the Christian. The late, great Chuck Misler once said this. He said, You can expect increasing laws to be enforced to try and encumber you as a biblical believer. The freedom of expression that we had in America, Canada, and Australia is starting to be curtailed. There are certain things you cannot talk about in public anymore. The thought control is beginning. the biblical believer will be the minority guy. The attack will include, if not led by, the denominations. And the substitutionary death of Jesus for our sins is a topic that is not comfortable from many pulpits. How many pulpits can you hear that from? A vanishing number in America. People who hold to those old-fashioned ideas will be continually marginalized. You have to understand how you persecute a group. And listen to this part, because I thought this was very good. He says, first you identify that group, then you marginalize that group, then you vilify that group, then you pass laws against what that group does. And finally, you simply enforce those laws. So he says, when the Gestapo broke down doors in the middle of the night and took away the head of the household, they were not breaking the law, they were enforcing the law. And the biblical believer has been promised persecution by our King, and it is coming. And most Christians aren't ready for that, but they need to be, he said. So they knew, these people, these satraps and administrators knew that they could only get Daniel if they put his devotion to God at odds with his devotion to the king and the laws of the land. And they would force him to have to choose which he would do. To disobey God would ruin his testimony and integrity. To disobey the laws of the land would get him prosecuted as one who would not be fully loyal to the king. Again, this is not just something that happened 2,600 years ago. This is the tactic of today as well, where Christian businesses and believers are specifically targeted to try and cause persecution and prosecution. So here was Daniel, a man who shone so brightly. Others were jealous and decided to try to put that light out. So off to the king they went, saying that all of the king's governors had agreed that for 30 days no one could pray to any other god. Now, of course, the all didn't include Daniel himself, who was strangely left out of this decision. And it seems that they flattered the king, exalting him to the place of God, and he bought it. J. Vernon McGee talks about flattery. He says, a long time ago, I discovered that I am not as bad as my enemies say, and I'm not nearly as good as my friends say that I am. There is always a danger of being carried away by flattery, he writes. And so the king, having been flattered, just made a quick, foolish decision without any consultation with Daniel that he would live to regret very soon. And so a seemingly foolproof plan was hatched, one that would definitely end with someone having lunch with lions. But the who is still yet to be determined. All right, let's have a look at the impact on Daniel. Did he change his ways? In verses 10 to 13, it says, now when Daniel learned that the decree had been published, he went home to his upstairs room where the windows opened towards Jerusalem. And three times a day he got down on his knees and prayed, giving thanks to God, just as he had always done. Then these men went as a group and they found Daniel praying and asking God for help. So they went to the king and spoke to him about his royal decree. Did you not publish a decree that during the next 30 days, anyone who prays to any god or man except to you, O king, would be thrown into the lion's den? And the king answered, the decree stands in accordance with the laws of the Medes and the Persians, which cannot be repealed. Then they said to the king, well, Daniel, who is one of the exiles from Judah, pays no attention to you, O king, or to the decree you put in writing. He still prays three times a day. So, upon hearing of this new decree, that no one can now pray, Daniel immediately goes home and prays. He purposely disobeyed the law, but not because he's a rebel. Far from it. It's just that God came first in his life, and there was nothing that he would let come before his relationship with the Lord. He didn't even close his windows so that he couldn't be seen. And you'll also note that he doesn't go home to moan at God about his predicament. No, he simply kneels and gives thanks to God, as he has always done. And there's a really good illustration for us here. You know, because in our own trying time, we see that Daniel could still give thanks. And that's what we need to do. I mean, that is faith that brings God into play. I've always liked what Bible commentator and teacher Matthew Henry wrote after being robbed. He wrote this: "I thank thee first, because I was never robbed before. Second, because although they took my purse, they did not take my life. Third, because although they took my all, it was not very much. And fourth, because it was I who was robbed and not I who robbed." It's really cool. It's fantastic to be able to look for ways to give thanks even in difficult situations. And you'll note that while Daniel starts by giving thanks, he also presents his request to God, asking God for help. So this is a perfect Old Testament example of what the New Testament truth concerning prayer says. In Philippians 4:6-7, "Do not be anxious about anything, but in everything by prayer and petition, with thanksgiving, present your requests to God. And the peace of God, which transcends all understanding, will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus." And Daniel would need and experience this peace, because he knew that in this very act of praying to God, this could very well book him a lunch appointment with some hungry lions. Now, we should also remember again that Daniel was in his, you know, probably early to mid-80s at this stage. And as such, he was a man with a lifetime of experiencing the faithfulness of his Lord. So because of this, Daniel wasn't easily freaked out. D.L. Moody once said that character is what you are in the dark. And we see from this verse where Daniel's strength lay. Especially when no one was looking. He was unshakable because of this firm foundation beneath him that held him up. And that was the Lord, the solid rock. So how would the king respond when told that Daniel had broken his new decree? In verses 14 to 7 it says, "When the king heard this, he was greatly distressed, and he was determined to rescue Daniel, and he made every effort until sundown to save him. And then the men went as a group to the king, and they said, 'Remember, O king, that according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, no decree or edict that the king issues can be changed.' So the king gave the order, and they brought Daniel and threw him into the lion's den. And the king said to Daniel, 'May your God, whom you serve continually, rescue you.' And a stone was brought and placed over the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet ring and with the rings of his nobles, so that Daniel's situation might not be changed." So here was Daniel. He was caught red-handed practicing that oh-so-terrible crime of praying to God. The plan had been hatched, the trap had been set, and it had now been sprung on God's godly servant Daniel. But I like how this reads in the New King James Version, which says, "And the king, when he heard these words, was greatly displeased with himself." You would think that when a king hears that someone in his kingdom has willfully disobeyed his orders, he would be displeased with them. But no, he was displeased with himself. You know, this king now realized that he had actually been flattered and tricked But there was nothing that he could do about it. A decree was a decree, and it must be acted upon. So even though the king is sorrowful when he realizes that the law that he agreed to is now being used to condemn Daniel, the law of the Medes and the Persians must be upheld. And thus Daniel is thrown into the lion's den. Now, there's a great little repeated prophetic pattern here, which points to Jesus. And we should always see the patterns that point to Jesus. So just as King Darius was pressured by Daniel's jealous peers to pass a law that would be used to condemn Daniel, so Pilate was pressured by Jesus' jealous peers to pass a law to condemn Jesus. And just as Daniel is put in the place of death, and the king seals the stone and Daniel's fate, supposedly, so Pilate would put his seal on the stone that was meant to keep Jesus in the place of death. And just as Daniel in the lion's den, God would have the last say, and death would not be the end, nor the victor, in either this case or with Jesus. Just as Daniel would emerge victorious and his enemies defeated, so the enemy was defeated at the cross of Jesus Christ. But more on that later. All right, let's have a look at verses 18 to 20 now. It says, "Then the king returned to his palace, and he spent the night without eating and without any entertainment being brought to him, and he could not sleep. And at the first light of dawn, the king got up and hurried to the lion's den. And when he came near the den, he called to Daniel in an anguished voice, 'Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to rescue you from the lions?'" We see here, like, the king was obviously very, very concerned for Daniel. And as someone once said, he fasted for the entire night, hoping that the lions would do likewise. So there's no food, no entertainment, not even sleep for this king. He really was concerned about what he had allowed to happen. Now, I like how he comes to the den at first light and calls out to Daniel. That shows faith. He didn't just peep over the edge, half squinting, scared of what he may see. He didn't know what would happen, but he knew that Daniel, and through knowing Daniel, he was beginning to know something about Daniel's God. And Daniel's God seemed different to Darius than the other gods. He seems to be a God that actually acts on behalf of his people. And so he calls out, "Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to rescue you from the lions?" Just as a little side note here, you'll notice that he calls Daniel's God the living God. That's very cool. It seems that that's a title that is used throughout the Old Testament, especially when action was required. To give you just some quick examples, in Joshua 3, it says, "Joshua said to the sons of Israel, 'Come here and hear the words of the Lord your God.' And Joshua said, 'By this you shall know that the living God is among you, and that he will assuredly dispossess from before you the Canaanite, the Hittite, the Hivite, etc.'" So through God's action, they would know that the living God was among them. In 1 Samuel 17, we read about Daniel. And it says, "Daniel spoke to the men who were standing by him. And he said, 'What will be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine,'" speaking of Goliath, "'that he should taunt the armies of the living God?'" He's reminding them again, we serve the living God. In 2 Kings 19, we when Hezekiah was faced with the Assyrian, the might of the Assyrian army, it says Hezekiah took the letter from the hand of the messengers and read it, and he went up to the house of the Lord and spread it out before the Lord. Incline your ear, O Lord, and hear. Open your eyes, O Lord, and see, and listen to the words of Sennacherib, whom he has sent to reproach the living God. Would you say that you're following the living God? Do you allow the Lord to have control in your life? And have you had times when you have seen the hand of the living God working his ways for you? It's a good question for all of us. All right, let's have a look now at how to shut a lion's mouth. In verses 21 to 23, with the king having just called out to Daniel, we read, Daniel answered, O king, live forever. My God sent his angel, and he shut the mouths of the lions. They have not hurt me, because I was found innocent in his sight, nor have I ever done any wrong before you, O king. And the king was overjoyed, and gave orders to lift Daniel out of the den. And when Daniel was lifted from the den, no wound was found on him, because he had trusted in his God. There are little pictures in here for us as well. The New Testament tells us that your enemy, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion looking for someone to devour. Resist him, it says, standing firm in the faith. So we, like Daniel, need to remain strong in our faith in the midst of any difficulties or persecutions, if and when they come. It's also important not to give the enemy reason to justifiably condemn us. Now we read, as I just read out, that Daniel was delivered from the lion and certain death because he was innocent before God. He had done no wrong to the king, but most importantly, he trusted in his God. And so, just as Psalm 34:7 tells us, the angel of the Lord encamps around those who fear him, and he delivers him. And what about Jesus? Because all these things point to Jesus. Why was he delivered from death? The Bible actually says that it was impossible for death to hold him. Acts 2:24, it says, God raised him from the dead, freeing him from the agony of death, because it was impossible for death to keep its hold on him. Why was that? Why was it impossible for death to keep its hold on Jesus? Well, firstly, he was raised because he was without sin, and therefore death, which is the wages for sin, could not hold him. Secondly, he was raised on the third day because the scriptures had been prophesied and they had to be fulfilled. Thirdly, he was raised so that in him we too may have new life. That's Romans 6:4. And he was raised defeating death so that in him we too may one day fully conquer this last enemy, that is death. That's 1 Corinthians 15:54-55. And I've always loved how C.S. Lewis pictured this event in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. After Aslan had seemingly died on the stone tablet, let me just read a quote. It says, at that moment, they heard from behind them a loud noise, a great crackling, deafening noise, as if a giant had broken a giant's plate. The stone table was broken into two pieces by a great crack that ran down it from end to end. And there was no Aslan. Who's done it? Cried Susan. What does it mean? Is it more magic? Yes, said a great voice from behind their backs. It is more magic. They looked around, and there, shining in their sunrise, larger than they had ever seen him before, shaking his mane, for it had apparently grown again, stood Aslan himself. Oh, Aslan! Cried both the children, staring up at him, almost as much frightened as they were glad. But what does it all mean? Asked Susan, when they were somewhat calmer. It means, said Aslan, that though the witch knew the deep magic, there is a magic deeper still that she did not know, and her knowledge goes back only to the dawn of time. But if she could have looked a little further back, into the stillness and the darkness before time dawned, she would have read there a different incantation. She would have known that when a willing victim who had committed no treachery was killed in a traitor's stead, the table would crack and death itself would start working backwards. I like that. So from this little passage, we can see that faith can shut the mouth of lions. So let me just ask you, what lions are you facing at the moment? What is it that causes you to worry and fear? Because sooner or later, we will all face lions in whatever form they come, whether it be opposition, slander, health issues, financial concerns, persecution. May we learn, as Paul himself did, that even if all else falls around our side, the Lord will still stand with us. And no doubt the Apostle Paul had Daniel 6 in mind when he wrote this in 2 Timothy. He said, at my first defense, no one supported me, but all deserted me. But the Lord stood at my side and gave me strength, that through me the message might be fully proclaimed and all the Gentiles might hear it. And I was delivered from the lion's mouth. God can shut the lion's mouth in whatever form it comes. So stand firm in your faith. In thankfulness, always look for something that you can thank God for. And Daniel's faith is also noted in the Hall of Faith in Hebrews 11. He's not named, but his actions are. Where the writer says, and what more shall I say? I do not have time to tell about Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, Daniel, Samuel, and all the prophets who through faith conquered kingdoms, administered justice, and gained what was promised, and who shut the mouths of lions. And this also should just be a good little prophetic pointer and application for us as well. Because as believers, we look forward to the day in the millennial kingdom when all the lion's mouth shall be shut for good and peace shall reign. Let me just read that one passage, Isaiah 11:6. It says, the wolf will lie down with the lamb, the leopard will lie down with the goat, and the calf and the lion and the yearling together, and a little child will lead them. So prophetically, one day, the lion's mouth and all opposition will be shut. All right, let's have a look at verse 24, because we can see that someone is going to be caught in their own deceptive web. It says, at the king's command, the men who had falsely accused Daniel were brought in and thrown into the lion's den, along with their wives and children. And before they reached the floor of the den, the lions overpowered them and crushed all their bones. Okay, so that's usually missing from the Sunday school versions of the story. We don't get to hear that all of these administrators, along with their wives and children, were actually thrown into the den and the lions overpowered them straight away. The scary thing about this group is that there were no angels to guard and protect those that didn't fear the Lord. You know, they'd been snared in their own trap, caught in their own deceptive web. And of course, the greatest ever example of this came the day when Jesus was nailed to a cross. And how Satan must have rejoiced as he turned the masses against Jesus. He would have been beside himself as darkness covered the land and the Son of God died a slow and agonizing death upon the cross. I've done it, he would have proclaimed, "I have killed the Son of God. I have stopped God, put an end to his plan." And yet, as Jesus breathed his last, strange things started to happen. The curtain in the temple was torn from top to bottom. The way into the Holy of Holies was open to all, and Satan's plan had backfired. I mean, that cross, that same cross that was meant to seal the fate of the Son of God, was actually the very thing that God used to seal Satan's fate and to set the captives free. And death itself would be defeated by the Son of God going down into death. I mean, what a plan, what a magnificent plan of God. It's as Paul writes when he's contemplating the amazing wisdom of God. He says, "Oh, the depth of the riches of the wisdom and knowledge of God, and how unsearchable his judgments and his paths beyond tracing out." So let's just now conclude with the last few verses and see what happens. And we'll see there's an amazing testimony of God to all the people. It says, "Then King Darius wrote to all the peoples, nations, and men of every language throughout the land, 'May you prosper greatly. I issue a decree that in every part of my kingdom, people must fear and reverence the God of Daniel. For he is the living God, and he endures forever, and his kingdom will not be destroyed. His dominion will never end. He rescues and he saves. He performs signs and wonders in the heaven and on the earth. And he has rescued Daniel from the power of the lions.'" So Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius and the reign of Cyrus the Persian. Look at the result of this trial from a personal point of view. Yeah, we can see the strength of a person's testimony is really proportional to the depth of the trial and the deliverance that they have experienced. And God knows what he's doing if we are asked to endure such a trial. Daniel, as you know, we've been talking about, was required to go through such a trial. But what a result. I mean, not only had Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon issued an earlier personal testimony to all of the then known world praising the God of Israel, that was in Daniel 4, but now Darius, the Medo-Persian king, has also issued a decree to all peoples that the God of Daniel must be feared and revered. That's amazing. So when we are down, when we are wondering what is happening, let us remember these words of Darius, and I will conclude with these. For he reminds us, as does this whole chapter, that firstly, God is a living God. We need to remember that. Secondly, that God endures forever. There will never come a time when God is not. He is the eternal I am. And then Darius reminds us that God is a God who rescues and saves. And he is a God who performs wonders on our behalf. These are good things to remember, even if you're currently feeling like you're down in the lion's den. God is active through all of these things. He has a purpose in all that we are allowed to go through. And so, as I've been talking about, may we learn to trust him in those situations. May we first of all learn to give thanks in those situations. Present our requests to God. But thank him in all things. He's the living God. He endures forever. He rescues and saves. He performs wonders on our behalf. May we praise and thank the Lord once again. Amen. All right, we will continue next time in chapter 7. It takes on a little bit, well, quite a big bit of a prophetic turn, giving both events on earth and in the heavens. And that's what we'll look at. So I trust that this has been a blessing to you, and I hope that you can tune in next time as well. Thanks once again. God bless.